on radio, online and mobile. You're with SBS Radio.
This is SBS World News Radio. I'm Greg Dyatt.
And I'm Darren Mara. Coming up, the federal government says asylum seekers on Manus Island should leave the detention centre.
These people were advised in May that this centre would be closed. Those who are found to be refugees will go to one facility. Those who are found not to be refugees will go to another facility.
Also tonight, a warm welcome for Malcolm Turnbull in Israel.
I'm very proud to have been the first Israeli Prime Minister to visit Australia. I'm delighted that you are here. Second time a Prime Minister visits Israel.
And the Senate President Stephen Parry tells Parliament he could be a dual citizen.
All those stories coming up in the next 30 minutes.
Good evening with the news at 6 o'clock. I'm Darren Mara. Senate President Stephen Parry could be the eighth parliamentarian caught up in the scandal over dual citizenship after revealing he may be a British citizen by descent. In a statement, the Tasmanian Liberal Senator says he has sought formal advice from British authorities over whether his father, who moved to Australia as a child in 1951, may have conferred him British citizenship. He says should the investigation find he is a dual citizen, he will be in breach of Section 44 of the Constitution and would resign without referring himself to the High Court. Hundreds of refugees and asylum seekers are refusing to leave the Australian-run detention centre on Manus Island as it prepares to shut down permanently. All staff have left the centre and there are reports of locals looting the site. Lawyers for the roughly 600 men in detention have lodged a Supreme Court application arguing their constitutionally protected human rights are being breached. Extra PNG police and defence forces have been deployed to the island ahead of the deadline. Acting Prime Minister Julie Bishop says Australia is working closely with Papua New Guinea to ensure the closure goes as smoothly as possible.
The Australian government is in constant communication with our counterpart ministers and departments within Papua New Guinea, and we are there to support PNG. Today, the regional processing centre on Manus Island will be closed, and the PNG government has made alternative accommodation arrangements for those who are found to be refugees and also for those who are not refugees and are not owed protection and who should leave and should go home.
In April 2016, the PNG Supreme Court ruled that Australia's detention of refugees and asylum seekers there was illegal and unconstitutional. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is in Israel to commemorate the centenary of the World War I Battle of Beersheba. Mr. Turnbull and his wife Lucy were welcomed by Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu before the two leaders met one-on-one. They will later attend commemorations along with Cabinet Ministers Josh Frydenberg and Dan Tehan, Opposition Leader Bill Shorten and Labour MPs Mark Dreyfus and Warren Snowden will also be there. US President Donald Trump has dismissed the first indictments in the probe of his campaign's ties to Russia as having nothing to do with him. One-time campaign manager for Mr. Trump, Paul Manafort, and associate Rick Gates have pleaded not guilty to charges of money laundering, tax fraud, conspiracy to defraud the United States, and other counts. It's also emerged that former campaign aide George Papadopoulos pleaded guilty earlier this month to making false statements to FBI agents. While the charges against Mr. Manafort and Mr. Gates were not related to their campaign work, Mr. Papadopoulos admits he lied to the FBI about his contact with foreign nationals he believed to be tied to the Russian government while he was a campaign advisor. White House spokesman Sarah Huckabee Sanders says the real collusion campaign occurred on the part of former Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton.
There's clear evidence of the Clinton campaign colluding with Russian intelligence to spread disinformation and smear the president to influence the election. We've been saying from day one there's been no evidence of Trump-Russia collusion, and nothing in the indictment today changes that at all.
Overseas, and Kenya's Electoral Commission says incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta has won 98% of the vote in a repeated election. His main rival, opposition leader Raila Odinga, boycotted last week's vote, which was marred by low turnout and violent protests in opposition strongholds. Mr. Kenyatta has welcomed any challenges to his victory.
Let them first and foremost exhaust their constitutionally laid out processes. Let them go to court. Let them do whatever they want. Nobody shall deny them of their constitutional right. Those issues we shall discuss later. As to my agenda going forward, I will discuss once the processes are over.
And in sports, Socceroos coach Ange Postecoglou has named a 25-man squad to face Honduras in the side's upcoming World Cup qualifier, including skipper Mila Jedernak, Jimmy Jago and Alex Gersbach. Postecoglou says he'll reveal more of his future plans after the home-and-away playoff that decides whether Australia makes it to the 2018 World Cup in Russia. He insists he'll see the journey through.
If I didn't believe in it, we wouldn't have started on that journey. So, no, we'll keep forging ahead in the way we want to play our football and make sure that, if anything, we can be even more aggressive in our approach than we have been. And hopefully, I think the road we're taking is the long road. I think the experience of even the two Syria games have been enormously beneficial for the players.
And now tomorrow's weather. Perth, mostly sunny 30. Adelaide, partly cloudy 22. Melbourne, a shower or two 17. Hobart, showers developing in 20. Canberra, partly cloudy 21. Wollongong, more cloud 20. Sydney, cloudy with a chance of a shower 21. Newcastle, similar conditions in 20. Brisbane, partly cloudy with light winds 28. Cairns, possible shower 31. And Darwin, a shower or two with a possible storm 35. Greg, more on those stories in SBS World News at 6:30.
Thanks, Darren. Right across Australia, this is SBS World News Radio, 6:07. The official Australian and New Zealand commemoration of the centenary of the Battle of Bathsheba is getting underway. Our Chief International Correspondent, Brett Mason, is covering the service.
2,000 people are expected to be participating in this service, which will hear from both the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. It will go for about an hour, and many of the descendants of the 31 Australians who died during the Battle of Bathsheba 100 years ago to this day will participate. They will be laying wreaths during this service, and from here they will join a convoy which will attend a Turkish commemoration, it will attend a New Zealand commemoration, and there will be a separate Australian commemoration at the Park of the Australian Soldier. That will be perhaps the centrepiece of these commemorations and will include a reenactment of that iconic charge. More than 150 people expected on horseback to recreate that iconic victory of the First World War. It will be a very emotional time. Many of the relatives here haven't met one another before, and they're connecting and sharing some of those stories for the very first time.
Have you had anyone express the sentiment to you, Brett, that unlike Gallipoli, this was indeed a victory and should get more precedence, more store put in it than what Gallipoli does?
That certainly has been something that a lot of relatives have told us. They talk about the fact that Gallipoli really has dominated a lot of discussions about the First World War, and this centenary has seen more and more people talking about the Western Front and the campaign here, which of course really did pave the way for the ultimate Allied victory in the First World War. It's interesting, though, you speak to some of the British military historians and authors, and they talk about the fact that this wasn't perhaps quite the victory, the significant turning point that the Prime Minister has spoken of. They say that while it was in some respects a cavalry charge, it certainly wasn't the last or the greatest or the biggest, and that this particular campaign in Bathsheba did pave the way in terms of the ongoing war in Gaza and that Allied victory, but it wasn't seen as a crucial battle because the Ottoman forces were depleted by the time the Light Horse Brigade charged in. So there are, of course, always with these types of events and battles, different interpretations of history, but the general consensus from everyone I've spoken to is that this particular theatre of war isn't one that people talk about perhaps as much as Gallipoli and certainly the Western Front, and that this commemoration is a real chance to remember not only the 31 Australians who died this day 100 years ago, but also troops from New Zealand, from Britain and from other Commonwealth countries who were fighting alongside as well many Palestinians who were joined in that campaign, believing that perhaps there might be, as the British had promised, the opportunity for self-rule in the future. So it is in many ways a complex history, but it is also a shared history between Australia and many, many others who had lost loved ones in this theatre of war.
Our Chief International Correspondent, Brett Mason. Well, ahead of the commemorations, Malcolm Turnbull received a warm welcome in Israel from his counterpart, Benjamin Netanyahu. The two leaders have declared Australia and Israel's relationship to be more profound than ever. Hannah Sinclair reports.
After delaying his trip briefly to deal with the fallout from the High Court's decision on dual citizenship, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has found a respite of sorts in Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his wife Sarah greeted him and his wife Lucy at a ceremonial welcome in Jerusalem. And Mr. Netanyahu has gone on to term Mr. Turnbull Mishpaka, or family. Mr. Turnbull says he indeed feels part of the same family, and he has gone on to depict an ever-warming relationship between the two countries. In Israel, to mark the centenary anniversary of World War I's Battle of Beersheba and Australia's role in it, he says the relationship is one of cooperation and collaboration.
We've seen over the century deeper and deeper cooperation and collaboration between Australia and Israel. And I think today it is at its height, but it has a long way to go. We have those shared values of which Bibi and I have both spoken. Freedom, the rule of law, democracy. Easy to trip off the tongue, but they're scarcer than they should be. And they require always determination, blood and treasure to defend and preserve.
The two leaders have signed a defence industry cooperation memorandum following a meeting upon Mr. Turnbull's arrival. The threat of what Mr. Turnbull terms Islamist terrorism was discussed, as well as the need to work together to tighten cybersecurity. Australia's Prime Minister says the two countries share a common goal in defeating that terrorism with IS or ISIL at the heart of it.
We face common threats, and we talked about those at length, the threat of Islamist terrorism in this region, where our armed forces are, of course, in the anti-ISIL coalition, and also, of course, in our own region, where we've seen ISIL-backed insurrections in the Philippines.
Mr. Turnbull described the Battle of Beersheba as a pivotal moment in history, led by the Australian horsemen as they helped liberate what was then Palestine from the Ottoman Empire. Mr. Netanyahu returned Mr. Turnbull's compliments throughout their press conference. He says the many battles Australian soldiers have fought have left a lasting impression on the Jewish community in Israel, starting back then.
The impression that Australian soldiers left on the Jewish community here in the land of Israel at the time was lasting. Tremendous sympathy, the informality, the warmth, the shared values that you so well described a few hours earlier when you spoke about this. This is all true. This is something that creates a sympathy, an identification, and a friendship that is real. And I know that people think that all international relations are guided by interests. Of course they are. But when interest coheres with values, there is something special.
Mr. Netanyahu has fondly recalled his February visit to Australia.
I'm very proud to have been the first Israeli Prime Minister to visit Australia. I'm delighted that you are here the second time a Prime Minister visits Israel. I think the future portends great things for both our countries, which are really one in values. So welcome, friend.
Opposition leader Bill Shorten is also among the Australian officials who have travelled to the commemorations at Beersheba. After political meetings in Jerusalem, he has visited the city of Ramallah in the West Bank to meet with Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Rami Hamdallah.
Hannah Sinclair reporting there. Still to come on the show, the leaders of the global Black Lives Matter movement say there are parallels between the American experience and that of Australia's Indigenous population.
Similar poverty rates, similar mass incarceration rates, the deaths in custody that are not being that are being swept under the rug. These are all things that we also feel in the U.S. And so there's a deep affinity around this resistance and this struggle.
You're listening to SBS World News Radio, and a reminder that you can now live stream the SBS TV bulletin at 6:30 each night by going to our website sbs.com.au/news. 17 past 6. Papua New Guinea's government says force will not be used to remove refugees from Australia's processing centre on Manus Island after fears that there would be violence as it shuts today. The refugees are refusing to leave despite the power, water and food being cut off, saying that the Manus community just isn't safe for them. The PNG government and the United Nations says Australia remains responsible for their well-being. Nikki Canning reports.
Refugees and asylum seekers are protesting against their imminent eviction from the Australian-run immigration centre on Manus Island. Shamindan Kanapadi is a Sri Lankan resident at the centre.
All of the guys here are really extremely worried and with tense here and frustrated, you know. The guards are left here, none of the guards are here, so we are worried about maybe the local people could come and attack us.
Today marks the end of more than 4 years of offshore immigration processing in Papua New Guinea. Acting Prime Minister Julie Bishop says the government will support those who've been found to be refugees.
The PNG government has made alternative accommodation arrangements for those who are found to be refugees and also for those who are not refugees and are not owed protection and who should leave and should go home.
PNG's Immigration Minister Petrus Thomas says there are still many unresolved issues.
Australia will have to continue support funding until the last man standing. That does not mean that it's conclusion of everything.
Food, water and power have been cut at the former detention centre to force the refugees to leave. Kate Schutzer is with Amnesty International and is on the island.
We're very concerned about what might happen today and the increased risks of violence around the proposed closure of the centre.
A final eviction notice warns, move now. Anyone choosing to remain here will be liable for removal from an active PNG military base. Immigration Minister Thomas says he doesn't expect any trouble.
I don't expect any force to be used while the transition or the movement is happening.
Heavy PNG police reinforcements are on Manus. Australian workers have left the centre and there are reports of looting by locals. Authorities want about 600 refugees and non-refugees moved to transit centres in the Manus community. But Shamindan Kanapadi says there's no place for them in PNG.
The PNG local people, they don't want us to be in their community. And in fact, the governor and member of parliament, he was saying that none of the refugees should come to their community. And we are really worried.
Refugees say they've been attacked and robbed and claim support services are lacking. Minister Thomas says there's only so much they can do and the country doesn't have the capacity to deal with the mental health of all the refugees and non-refugees on Manus. Housing and services for refugees in PNG will cost Australia up to $250 million over the next year, and there's been no further word on US resettlement. Catherine Studderfield from UNHCR Australia says they've visited the centre and Australia remains responsible.
Fundamentally, this is a situation created by Australia. It's been maintained by Australia and it's been financed by Australia. Unless and until adequate and long-term solutions are found for all refugees and asylum seekers transferred to Papua New Guinea, Australia's responsibility will continue.
Immigration Minister Peter Dutton's released a statement saying Manus will shut and rejecting safety and welfare concerns.
And that report was produced by Stefan Armbruster. Coming up a little later, Australian anti-apartheid activists are being honoured in a new exhibition in South Africa.
We actually did stop sporting tours. We actually did start the isolation of South Africa and the eventual end of apartheid.
Here, the leaders of the global Black Lives Matter movement say that there are parallels between the American experience and that of Australia's Indigenous population. At a forum in Sydney, they met key Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander figures to share strategies and solutions on how to tackle issues faced by their respective communities. Abby O'Brien reports.
Since it began in 2013, the Black Lives Matter movement has been on the front lines of protests across the United States, protesting against police brutality and high incarceration rates among the country's black community. Driving the now global campaign is its co-founder, Patrice Cullors, who says the struggle is not unique to America. She cites the experience of Australia's Indigenous community.
Similar poverty rates, similar mass incarceration rates, the deaths in custody that are not being that are being swept under the rug. These are all things that we also feel in the US. And so there's a deep affinity around this resistance and this struggle.
Ms. Cullors is in Australia with her Canadian counterpart, Rodney Devilis. They are here to accept the 2017 Sydney Peace Prize, Australia's leading award for global peacemakers. It marks the first time the prize has been awarded to an organisation rather than an individual. Mr. Devilis says his visit has another purpose.
I think it's time for us to stand together as brothers and sisters in the global fight. We are invested in having a global conversation on the ways that we can resist these atrocities and the ways that we can fight for human rights for our people.
The pair are meeting leaders and advocates from Australia's Indigenous community. Cheryl Axelby is the co-chair of the Change the Record Coalition, which calls for urgent action to close the gap in imprisonment rates between Indigenous and other Australians. She says the discussions are looking at the challenges faced by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, not just in the Australian context, but from a global perspective.
Having our brothers and sisters here is going to give our communities great insight into the great work that they've been doing in their own countries and to look at what we can do from here on.
Antoinette Braybrook, also a co-chair of the Change the Record Coalition, says the two communities will be exchanging ideas and experiences.
We might share different strategies and find different solutions on how to tackle that systemic racism and discrimination.
Nathan Moran is the CEO of the Metropolitan Local Aboriginal Lounge Council. He's hoping the support of the Black Lives Matter campaign will add momentum to the Australian movement.
Considering our reality is we're 3% of the population, to achieve any influence we need other brothers and sisters around the planet of similar backgrounds.
Nathan Moran, CEO of the Metropolitan Local Aboriginal Land Council, ending that story by Abby O'Brien. Australian anti-apartheid activists are being honoured in a new exhibition in South Africa. Reflecting on the boycott of all-white South African sporting teams, organisers say it shows the power of protest. This report from Rosemary Bolger.
Onto the field go the first two, three, four demonstrators of the afternoon. Three of them are women.
As a student activist, Meredith Bergman jumped the fence at the Sydney Cricket Ground during the 1971 game between the Wallabies and the racially selected Springboks.
I remember thinking when I got onto the ground, wow, I didn't ever think I'd get over the fence. And then I thought, what do I do now? So we just ran onto the players, and my sister actually got the ball out of the scrum and kicked it, and the bulletin called it the best kick of the season. And whereas I just lay down in front of the players.
The famous images of her being dragged off the ground are part of a new exhibition at the Johannesburg Supreme Court, where Nelson Mandela was once imprisoned. Also in the exhibition is Dr. Bergman's correspondence with Australian cricket icon Don Bradman that helped convince him to cancel the upcoming tour of the South African team.
I could tell it this was an older man struggling with the whole idea of should Australia be playing a racially selected team, which was really the issue.
Importantly, his decision wasn't due to safety concerns for the players, but on principle. Anthony Abrams played 13 matches for the Wallabies, but is best known for leading the campaign against the 1971 Springbok tour after seeing the situation in South Africa firsthand.
The whites-only benches around the towns, the separation of toilets, the whole society was a divided society based on race.
While the tour went ahead without Abrams and six other players taking the field, it would be the last time Australia met South Africa on the sporting field for more than two decades.
The lead up to the tour got people in Australia thinking about it, and we watched the public opinion polls progressively change in favour of the position of those who wanted to stop the tour until I think it ended up roughly 50-50. And it was a a thought-provoking experience for many people in Australia, just not only in the rugby states.
He dismisses any suggestions that sport and politics don't mix, citing the NFL players kneeling during the American national anthem.
Saying with regard to those who make a stand, who are involved in sport, that their obligations and their issues as human beings don't stop at the turnstile of a sporting ground.
It's one of the many lessons from the campaign, says Jane Singleton. As chair of the African National Congress support group, she organised Nelson Mandela's visit to Australia before he became president.
Even in 1990, the then Premier of New South Wales would not meet Nelson Mandela publicly. So a 20-year campaign, but it changed the lives of hundreds of thousands of South Africans.
She says today's long-running campaigns often struggle to gain the same traction.
People have been concerned about a number of issues. The big debate now about yes, no, about same-sex marriage. How do you actually make the protest affect a change? And I think that's what the exhibition shows us. It takes us from protest to change.
Meredith Bergman says the activist trio is looking forward to being in Johannesburg for the exhibition opening.
It'll really hit us for the first time how important the international struggle was for the end of apartheid. It really is the great international campaign of the 60s and 70s because it actually worked. You know, we actually did stop sporting tours. We actually did start the isolation of South Africa and the eventual end of apartheid.
Meredith Bergman ending that story by Rosemary Bolger. Time now for a check of the news headlines. The Senate President Stephen Parry says he sought confirmation from British authorities of whether he's a dual citizen and will resign if it's confirmed. The Attorney General, George Brandis, says Senator Parry, as well as other politicians embroiled in the citizenship crisis, have done nothing wrong.
For the time being, until the facts are clearly established, there is really not anything more that can usefully be said about the matter. It's important to note that Senator Parry came forward voluntarily, as indeed had those government senators and Mr. Joyce himself, who also found themselves in Section 44 difficulties.
The Australian Bureau of Statistics says 12.3 million voters have returned their same-sex marriage postal surveys, representing 77% of those who are entitled to vote. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern will travel to Australia this weekend to meet with Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull in her first trip as PM. And Japan is set to launch a crackdown on asylum seekers, curbing their rights to work and detaining any not deemed refugees or who have multiple applications. The rules could impact more than 10,000 asylum seekers a year who don't qualify for refugee status. Well, that's SBS World News Radio for now. You can see SBS World News across Australia at 6:30, and you can live stream the bulletin by going to our website, sbs.com.au/news. I'm Greg Dyett. Thanks for listening.